Hello and welcome to another IntensiveCareHotline.com and IntensiveCareAtHome.com live stream. Ask me anything, life support, ICU decisions, tracheostomy, intensive care at home. That is what we want to talk about today. My name is Patrick Hutzel from IntensiveCareHotline.com and IntensiveCareAtHome.com, where we help families of critically ill patients to improve their lives instantly, making sure they can make informed decisions, have peace of mind, control, power and influence, even if you're not a doctor or a nurse in intensive care, and making sure your loved one gets best care and treatment always. And I'm also the founder and managing director of IntensiveCareAtHome.com, where we send our critical care nurses into the home for predominantly long-term ventilated adults and children with tracheostomies, where we also look after tracheostomy clients at home without ventilation, home BiPAP, home CPAP, home TPN, cough assist, anything that is medically complex at home, where we send our critical care nurses into the home. With intensive care at home, currently we're operating all around Australia in all major capital cities, as well as in all regional and remote areas. With intensive care hotline, like I said, we are consulting and advocating for families in intensive care all around the world. And we've been doing so with IntensiveCareHotline.com since 2013. And we've been operating intensive care at home since 2012. And I can very, very, very confidently say that we have saved many lives for our clients in intensive care, as is evidenced on our testimonial section on our websites and also on our podcast section where we've done client interviews. So usually I go for about an hour on this YouTube live stream. So this is your opportunity to talk to me live, ask any questions you may have. You can type them in the chat pad or you can connect with me live on the StreamYard link that I posted in the chat pad. I also want to welcome our viewers that watch this show on replay, because I know it gets quite a large number of views on replay as well. What makes me qualified to host a show where you can ask me anything about life support decisions in ICU, tracheostomy and intensive care at home? Once again, my name is Patrick Hutzel. I am a critical care nurse by background, having worked in critical care nursing for over 25 years in three different countries, where I worked as a nurse manager in intensive care for over 5 years. And I've been consulting and advocating for families in intensive care here at IntensiveCareHotline.com since 2013. And like I said, we've been operating intensive care at home since 2012. Without further ado, I do want to start with a testimonial that we've had coming in earlier in the week. And I want to, of course, read out that testimonial where one of our clients has said, just got to find it now. Can't find it right now, but in the meantime, I'll be looking it up. In the meantime, if you have any questions, type them into the chat pad, of course. If you have any questions, you know, just post them here. Where do I find this? Here it is. So, hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for your help. Your help has been so invaluable to us. I can't even explain how much gratitude we have for you and your intensivecarehotline.com team. We had a meeting with the ICU medical director, neurologist, and social worker today. The social worker has finally been clarifying on family law and will no longer challenge me because of the letter investigation you provided and helped me with. Thank you. No one challenged us this time, and they've now agreed to release my grandson's medical records, and I've completed the Freedom of Information document, and they're fast-tracking it. We should have the medical records in a couple of hours. Once again, I can't thank you enough. This is what I've been saying for the longest here on this podcast, that if you're not getting access to medical records, it's your own fault, assuming you are the power of attorney and you have the rights to access medical records. But, you know, ICUs will always brush you off, and your biggest leverage point is to get expert advice. And one of your other biggest leverage points is to get expert advice, but also to be persistent. Okay. If you're not persistent, you're making sure ICUs get the upper hand. You cannot afford to have ICUs get the upper hand. It's as simple as that. Right? Don't let anybody walk all over you when you have a family member in intensive care. It is that important. It is that simple, right? So one thing that I want to talk about today is actually the difference between DCD organ donation and brain death organ donation, because this is something that has come up this week with the work that we're doing with one of our clients, right? So let's look at the difference before I go into the specifics about what's happened this week with one of our clients. So the two main pathways for organ donation after death are DCD, donation after circulatory death, and brain death organ donation. Here's a clear comparison of the two. Number one, brain death organ donation, DBD, donation after brain death. The definition that this form of organ donation occurs when a person is declared legally and medically dead due to irreversible loss of all brain functions, including the brain stem, but their heart is still beating with mechanical ventilation. Key characteristics: the donor is declared dead based on neurological criteria. Organs remain well perfused with oxygenated blood until they are removed. Organs are in optimal condition due to continued circulation. Typically, this type of organ donation allows for more types of organs to be donated: heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, pancreas, intestines. Common scenario: severe brain injury, i.e. trauma, stroke, anoxic brain injury, where brain function ceases permanently, but circulation is maintained by a ventilator. Next form of organ donation is donation after circulatory death, DCD. This level of organ donation occurs when a person does not meet brain death criteria, but its decision is made to withdraw life-sustaining treatment and the person dies due to cardiac arrest. What are the key characteristics? The key characteristics are that the donor is declared dead based on circulatory criteria, irreversible cessation of heartbeat and breathing. After the heart stops and a waiting period, usually 2 to 5 minutes, confirms death, organ recovery begins. It's time sensitive. Organs may suffer ischemic injury due to lack of oxygen before retrieval. Typically used for kidneys, liver, lungs, sometimes pancreas, heart donation is less common and more complex in DCD. Common scenario: patient with catastrophic brain injuries or terminal illness who does not meet brain death criteria, but for whom life support is being withdrawn with family consent. biggest word for me here is life support is being withdrawn with family consent. A lot of families in ICU still think that ICUs can make the decision about withdrawing life support without their consent. Right? ICUs are very good at pretending they can do whatever they want. Now, withdrawing life support without your consent could be perceived as euthanasia, could be perceived as murder even. Right? So let's look at this in more detail, the type of death, brain death, donation, DBD, irreversible loss of brain function. Circulatory death is the irreversible loss of heart function. Next, circulation at time is ongoing for brain death donation, ongoing ventilator support, whereas for DCD, circulatory death donation, it's stopped. Organ perfusion for brain death donation is intact at time of retrieval, and for circulatory death donation is interrupted after withdrawal of treatment. Next, organ viability for brain death donation is generally speaking higher, whereas for DCD may be reduced to warm ischemia. And ischemia means basically no oxygen perfusion to the organs. Next, organs commonly donated. Brain death donation is all major organs, including heart. And for DCD, it's mainly kidneys, liver, and lungs. Legal death declaration is neurological criteria for brain death donation, and it's circulatory criteria, i.e. cardiac arrest, for DCD. So, this is very, very important, and let me tell you why this came up as a topic for me this week. So we've been working with a client who has a family member in intensive care with query brain death. And in the last few days, brain death has actually been confirmed, unfortunately, with all the rigorous testing that needs to happen. What's also important to mention here, it is so important that brain death is tested rigorously by two doctors independently and also often by a contrast CT brain scan. And all of that has been done. And unfortunately, the reality is that this particular patient in intensive care is brain dead. But what turned to be out is that, you know, whilst the ICU has been telling the family that their family member has been brain dead from day one of admission, you know, the client had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. There was a long time of resuscitation before the cardiac function came back, right? The ICU was adamant that the client was brain dead from day one, but there was no evidence for it. Now, it turned out that the family was told that they could go down the path of DCD, donation after circulatory death, which was a sign that their family member was not brain dead right from the start, that brain death might have occurred later, you know, a few days later. So, but semantics play a big role here. Hi, Helene, nice to see you again. Semantics play a big role here because if the patient was not brain dead right from the start, which has been evidenced by the ICU suggesting DCD donation after circulatory death, and then as time went on, the ICU was saying, oh, now their family member is brain dead, now we could go to brain death organ donation. Right. Now, the important aspect here is, why did this client or patient go from not being brain dead to brain death? Now, we could only find that out in the medical records. And this is why I keep saying here over and over and over again that you need access to the medical records from day one. Right. If you don't get access to the medical records from day one, you are fighting an uphill battle, right? Because what came to light here by us now looking at the medical records is that initially the patient was not brain dead, and then at some point they were brain dead, but has there potentially been medical negligence in the meantime? You know, initially the patient was coughing, was trying to open eyes, but the family was told their family member is brain dead, which is not accurate if someone is coughing or opening eyes, right? It was also found that on day one, the ICU issued an illegal DNR without informing the family, right? So it is absolutely your responsibility and your responsibility only to get access to medical records from day one so you can actually get to the bottom of it, right? If you don't take responsibility for it, you can't also take responsibility for your loved ones' survival. You can't, right? So in this situation, what turns out to be is that also the patient was on paralyzing agents, right, on muscle relaxants, which is also a sign that he was not brain dead. Because if someone is brain dead, they are a Gluskin coma scale of 3. They're not doing anything. No need to chemically restrain them, i.e. muscle relaxants or paralyzing agents. Okay? I cannot tell you how much the devil is in the detail when you have a loved one in intensive care, unless you have someone like myself who understands intensive care inside out, looking at things in the detail that it needs to be looked at. You are fighting an uphill battle, right? Also, when we finally got access to the medical records in this case, I could see straight away that the ICU was still withholding information, right? We got, I think, 60 pages of medical records for a 9 or a 10 day stay in ICU, and I could see straight away that it is not all medical records, right? So 60 pages for 9 or 10 days in ICU is not enough, right? That's basically roughly six pages a day, and an ICU produces more than 6 pages a day in a 24-hour cycle for medical records, right? But the bottom line here is this: you need to get to the bottom of it. You cannot trust blindly, unfortunately, right? And you need to know the difference between things, and you need to understand why they're doing certain things, why they're potentially not doing certain things, why they're offering certain treatments, why they're potentially withholding certain treatments, right? So super important that you have an understanding of the semantics, that you have an understanding of procedures in ICU, because if you're not, then you are fighting an uphill battle. Now, then we had another testimonial that I'd like to read out. Hi, Patrick. Hang on. No, sorry, I just got to find it. There it is. There it is. Another testimonial. Hi, Patrick. Thank you for your perspective and advice during my father's recent ICU 2-week stay. You saved him from a tracheostomy, which was not necessary. He would have had yet another unnecessary surgery, which could have resulted in his death. We did let them put in the feeding tube just to get him out of ICU, but they kept insisting he needed to go to LTAC. Obviously, this is a client in the US. We brought him home on July the 1st. He has been doing exceptionally well. He started eating within days and will hopefully not need the feeding tube within a week or so. I wish we would have known about your service before we agreed to the surgery to supposedly remove the blood from his brain from his latest fall. After the surgery, they told us there was no pressure from the blood. Therefore, we are not sure if it was indeed necessary or not. At least he's now home and recovering. His speech has miraculously returned as well. Prior to this, his speech was unintelligible due to his advanced Parkinson's. He's now doing physical therapy and speech therapy and playing dominoes with his great grandkids. How good is that? Truly appreciate your insight and quick advice once we were able to get the hospital records. I will be recommending you to my friends, family, and anyone that may face an ICU situation. Thank you once again from Teresa. That's another sign that, you know, getting expert advice to get that second opinion is absolutely critical, because what did the ICU want in this situation? The ICU wanted to do a tracheostomy and send this man to an LTAC as quickly as possible. That's what the ICU wanted, right? And because of that, he would have ended up in an LTAC with a tracheostomy, right? A tracheostomy has its time and its place, right? The tracheostomy has its time and its place, but only for a few select patients, right? It's not the norm. Your first question for anyone in an ICU that is on a breathing tube should be, what are they doing to move towards extubation, i.e. the removal of the breathing tube? What are they doing? Are they doing everything beyond the shadow of a doubt? And B, what are they doing to avoid the tracheostomy? Are they doing everything beyond the shadow of a doubt to avoid the tracheostomy? Right? Now, Helen, you're saying brain dead was the lie they told you at Emory Hospital. Yes, and that's not your fault, because, you know, you didn't know what you didn't know at the time. But now you know that having access to the medical records is absolutely crucial, right? And now you know that when, just because an ICU is telling you that someone is brain dead, you got to verify that. There's a big difference between someone being severely brain damaged and someone being brain dead. There is a difference, right? And for anyone to know the difference is often the difference between life or death. That's how critical this is. Now, I would also like to read out a letter from, or an email from, one of our clients that was sent to the hospital that we advised them to send. That really gave them a good outcome. And that is why you can pretty much copy and paste that letter if you are in a situation like it. Yes, here's the letter. So this is I'll give you some context first before I read out the email. So this is a client who ended up in ICU, a 51-year-old man, ended up in ICU with a hemorrhagic stroke, with a massive brain bleed. And the ICU said that, you know, he will not survive. The ICU said he will not have any quality of life if he does survive, but he won't survive anyway, because he'll just die in the next few days. They were even going as far that they were threatening the family and saying, oh, today is the day where he's going to die, as if they could predict that, right? Family reached out to us and obviously asked for advice. And I said to them, look, you know, where's the rush to kill your brother? You know, and they were adamant that they would want to stop treatment, you know, were trying to force the family to agree to stopping treatment. And they said, oh, if you don't agree to it, we will make the decision. Well, ICUs are not allowed to make that decision. And like I say to you, ICUs are very good to pretend that they can do whatever they want until you challenge them. Right. So, and lo and behold, let's read out the letter first. So, to hospital executive, my name is Kristen, and I have changed all names here. I will not mention any hospital names. I will not mention any locations. You know, this is all anonymous, but it's a real case scenario. My name is Chris, and I write this letter on behalf of my sister-in-law, Natasha, and our family regarding the treatment and communication we have received in relation to my brother, John, who is currently in the intensive care unit at Hospital X. We are deeply concerned about the overall approach and lack of empathy shown by some of the ICU staff and doctors. Within just the second or third day of John's admission, discussions were already being held about the possibility of ending his life. These conversations were presented with an overwhelming focus on the negative, painting a picture of paralysis, no speech, no mobility, without even an ounce of hope or balance. We were confronted with the question, do you think John would want to live like this? This line of questioning was distressing and frankly premature, especially considering the emotional state of our family at that time. This experience left us feeling uncertain, insecure, and unsupported. As a result, I felt compelled to engage a private ICU nurse consultant, which is myself and my team, to advocate and help interpret the medical situation and provide clear, independent advice, something we believed should have been delivered with more transparency and structure by the hospital team. To this date, medical updates have only been provided during ad hoc meetings without any agenda or adequate preparation, which places significant strain on the family. This lack of structure and consistency has made it difficult for us to stay fully informed and involved in John's care. As a result, I will be seeking direct access to John's medical information and medical records through the appropriate channels, including a Freedom of Information request, to ensure we have a comprehensive understanding of his condition and care, and so that we can also get an independent second opinion. We understand and accept the severity of John's brain injury, and we do not take lightly the reality of what his future life might entail. However, the decision regarding John's care, especially around life-sustaining measures, is one that rests with his wife and immediate family and with nobody else. We ask that this to be respected at all times, and that John's time in the ICU be guided by a commitment to preserving life and ensuring his comfort, rather than overshadowed by defeat and negativity. Furthermore, I wish to raise a formal request regarding the use of light therapy in John's room. I have conducted thorough research and provided evidence, including websites and studies, which outline the benefit of red light therapy in supporting neurological recovery, calming inflammation, and improving overall well-being. It is a non-invasive therapy and could offer some comfort and healing, however minimal. We have been advised that this may not be permitted in John's room, but no clear reason has been provided. We respectfully ask that this decision to be reconsidered with an open mind, particularly as we explore every possible avenue, both medical and holistic, to support John's healing journey. We know that to many, John may be one of many patients, but to us, he's a father, son, brother, and husband. We've been told bluntly that he will likely die in hospital and never return home. While we understand the reality of his situation, we are also seeking compassion, understanding, and a glimmer of hope, something that we feel has been missing from the hospital's approach and from the ICU's approach. We are not asking for miracles. We are asking for empathy, for space to hope, and for the hospital to walk this difficult path and journey with us, not ahead of us. We look forward to your response. Now, his incredible family who refused to give up despite being told by the ICU team that he won't survive, that he would never speak, and that he would most likely die in hospital. Now, what happened after that? I was present in two meetings with the family in ICU and strongly advocated for full treatment for his survival, and that when the ICU team wanted to move to a quote-unquote one-way extubation, i.e. they wanted to remove the breathing tube, and not put it back in. And it was clear to me that they were not telling the family the truth. They were basically making it look like, oh yeah, we'll remove the breathing tube and then we'll see what happens. Well, it was crystal clear to me that he would die, but the ICU wasn't saying it that way because at that stage, the family had already pushed back big time. So I said, if they would extubate him and not put the breathing tube back in with a hemorrhagic stroke, he will end up with an aspiration pneumonia. He will aspirate on his saliva and he will die. And the ICU agreed with that, that after I called them out on it. So at that stage, the ICU had not mentioned anything to the family about a tracheostomy as an option. The family had no idea about what a tracheostomy is and, you know, whether that would even be an option. You know, the interesting part here is I just read out a testimonial a minute ago where we helped a family to avoid a tracheostomy because it was the right thing to do. And now the patient is at home thriving, right? In this situation, we helped advocate the family for a tracheostomy because it was the right thing to do, right? Like I say, tracheostomies have their time and their place. For certain patients, they need to happen. For other patients, they by no means need to happen, right? So I was in two family meetings with this family advocating for his survival and advocating for a tracheostomy, right? What ICUs often don't know, and obviously this was on a local level because, you know, and I could go there in person. What ICUs here in Australia still don't know is that the NDIS is an option to get patients out of ICU. So this ICU was worried about that if the patient ends up with a tracheostomy, that they would block an ICU bed and a hospital bed for days, weeks, or months to come. And that is certainly a reality. But what they also don't understand is that with NDIS funding now, that those patients can go home quicker, right? And that they can even go home with a tracheostomy because a stroke is an NDIS-funded diagnosis, right? So ICUs need to stop worrying about that these patients are going to be a burden for the hospital system because they're not. So, fast forward, patient ended up with a tracheostomy. On Friday, I spoke to the patient's brother. You know, and now he is on a hospital ward with a tracheostomy. He's being mobilized, he's sitting in a chair. He's pulling out his nasogastric tube, which is a good sign, even though he still needs it. He can't eat and drink yet. He's pulling out his nasogastric tube, but that's a good sign. That's for someone who was never meant to wake up, who was going to die, where the doctors were bluntly asking John, or whether the doctors and ICU were bluntly asking the family, would John want to live like this? While painting a bleak and hopeless picture, no speech, no paralysis, immobility, and no quality of life. This was not only premature, it was emotionally damaging to the family who was still processing the shock to his condition. But instead of caving to the pressure, John's sister and sister-in-law, they took action, right? He also had some ice cream, you know, also had some ice cream this week, you know, which is incredible. And he was even trying to speak, right? So you have to question the judgment of ICU teams at times, and you need to question. You need to question everything, right? So you need to question everything. You know, it seemed impossible just a few weeks ago, and now he's making progress. Now his brother also told me that every day has been progress. Whilst baby steps, they can see the steps. You know? And Elaine, you're saying that they were trying to cover up iatrogenic, egregious personal injury, septic shock, stroke, and respiratory failure. And your mum was suffering severely, suffered a personal injury, aspiration pneumonia. Yeah. Yeah. So, but it shows in this case, you know, the power of strong advocacy from family and from professionals like us. Both needs to happen. Both need to happen hand in hand. When hospitals are ready to give up too soon for their own agenda and their own agenda only. I mean, I continue to see this pattern every day. ICU teams often push for quote-unquote end-of-life decisions within the first few days, sometimes even within the first few hours of ICU admission, especially with brain injuries or ventilator dependency. But recovery takes time. Brain injuries in particular are especially notoriously unpredictable, and many patients have made recoveries weeks or even months after being written off by their treating teams. Now, in this case, if our client cannot leave hospital with a tracheostomy, that's where intensive care at home comes in, right? This is why we have solutions for almost everything. We have solutions with consulting and advocacy, but we also have solutions for home care when it comes to tracheostomy, long-term ventilation, all those things. Right? So, because we understand families in intensive care and we help families just like yours to push back, ask the right questions, understanding your rights, exercising them, and we keep fighting when hospitals stop caring, you know. But we also help hospitals now to understand that NDIS, especially in Australia, is obviously one of the funding streams that will help to eliminate long-term stays in ICU, right? So this is another real success story, you know. And I will keep you updated here how things are going there in the next few weeks. Right? In other updates, I had an email from a client this week who says in an email, Hi Patrick, at this time I am still in the healing process from the most traumatic event of my life. This was her husband passed away in ICU. Although I think having a skilled practitioner to go through the medical records of my husband's last couple of days would answer some very important questions that I still have. I still don't think that I'm ready to hear those answers. I'm also a little unsure as to what would be the most important information to actually send to you. Well, the most important information is always to send a full set of medical records, because if you're not having a full set of medical records, number one, makes you wonder what other hospitals potentially trying to withhold from you. What other hospitals worried to not give you access to? Right? Always get access to all medical records so that there's full transparency. So then she continues. Malcolm, my husband was in the hospital in the critical care and recovery ward for 7 weeks before his passing. I contacted and spoke with Patrick within the last 24 hours of his life because I was so filled with doubt. Let me repeat that, because I was so filled with doubt about how he was being treated. Now, let me ask you this. How many of you watching this have a family member in intensive care and you are in doubt with how your family member is being treated? But you're not taking action, you're not reaching out. Your gut is telling you something's not right, but you don't have the guts to question, right? So then, would you be able to come to an informed conclusion about what went wrong and whether there was something more that could have been done? Please remember that this is only for my benefit. There is no legal recourse or even an opportunity to open the outcome with the hospital at this point. Do you find that families feel a little more closure after having a review done of the type that you perform? Thanks for your help. Of course, families feel not a little bit more closure, they feel a lot more closure after having a review done by a medical professional, like from one of our team members here at intensivecarehotline.com. You wouldn't reach out to me if it wasn't nagging on you that something wasn't quite right. You can trust your gut. My advice is always trust your gut. Your gut never lies. Trust your gut, and also never ever or always use common sense. Never let common sense dissuade you or blind you to what you're seeing. If you think something's not common sense, you're probably right. If ICU keeps telling you we should just stop your loved one's life and we should just stop treating your loved one, common sense would be telling you that's not right. Follow that. Don't let the quote-unquote perceived authority from intensive care teams dissuade you from using common sense and following your gut. Now, the other thing that I quickly wanted to highlight, and obviously this is your opportunity to talk to me directly here. If you want to talk to me directly here, use the StreamYard link that I posted in the chat pad. I've just posted it again. Or type your questions into the chat pad and I will answer them here. Right? Now, next, I also want to quickly talk about an independent medical review for one of our intensive care at home NDIS participants at home who's on a ventilator with a tracheostomy. He's got a very long standing medical history with cerebral palsy, heart disease, and so forth. And I want to break down a powerful and eye-opening independent medical report written by an associate professor regarding an NDIS participant of ours that we've looked after for many years, who's ventilator dependent and lives with a tracheostomy. This particular report makes it very clear and crystal clear that 24/7 critical care registered nurses, not just any other RN registered nurse, and definitely not disability support workers, are absolutely essential to keep this NDIS participant alive and out of ICU. So let's look at the reality. This particular client has a single lumen tracheostomy, high risk of dislodgement. And a high risk of dislodgement, or dislodgement, means that the client could die within minutes or seconds. Also, he's chronically ventilator dependent. He cannot be off that ventilator for even 2 minutes, right? So what does that mean? If someone doesn't recognize that the patient is off the ventilator, which can happen unless you've got a trained eye as a critical care nurse, right? Patients can die. Now, I give you a real case scenario here, moving away from this case study for one moment. One of our other ventilated NDIS clients in the community, an MND client, we're doing night shifts there at the moment, but we're slowly but surely moving to day shifts as well because the client is 24-hour ventilated, you know, needs critical care nurses 24 hours a day. Part of the advocacy that we've done so far is that his patient had support workers. And one incident that happened with support workers is that, you know, they briefly disconnected the ventilator for giving some care around the tracheostomy, whatever the case may be. They put the ventilator back on the tracheostomy and then they realized, no. Then the client's family member realized the ventilator is not switched on. Now, can you imagine you're putting a patient that is fully ventilator dependent back on the ventilator and you are forgetting to switch the ventilator back on? That could have resulted easily in a patient death. And that is what's happening when it comes to disability support workers. Right? So, coming back to the medical report, so chronic ventilator dependency, if you have support workers, patients can die, clearly. Now, this client also has uncontrolled epilepsy, grand mal and petit mal seizures. He's having severe dystonia and spastic quadriplegia, osteoporosis with multiple fractures. Autonomic dysreflexia episodes can be life-threatening in minutes. PEC and port decathlons requiring expert nursing management. Okay, then I've got Ulas here who says, my son after GBS, either Guillain-Barre syndrome probably, and then cardiac arrest, then coma of 1 month, out of coma 1 month now, only opening eye movement of neck, following my oral command through eye and slightly through neck, ventilator dependent. From India, what's next? He's taking 5 to 6 breaths only. Can I just clarify, Ulas, GBS, you are talking about Guillain-Barre syndrome. Can you just quickly confirm that? What do you mean with AIDP? That is an abbreviation I'm not familiar with. What's AIDP? I just quickly need to look it up. AIDP. Acute inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, which is, yeah, that's Guillain-Barre syndrome. Okay, got it. Okay. So, does he have a tracheostomy? That's the first question. Does he have a tracheostomy, Ulas? That is the very first question. He's got a tracheostomy. Okay, good. Yes and yes. Okay, makes sense. That makes sense. Then the next question here is he still in ICU? Where is he? PEC feeding. Yep. Okay. Can he wee? What ventilator settings is he on? Help me understand what ventilator settings he is on. Because once I know what ventilator settings he's on, I can probably guide you to the next steps. But I need to know what ventilator settings he's on. And this is what I mean. You know, you don't even know what you don't know. You know, ventilator settings would be FiO2, 35%. That's 1 out of 10 numbers, Ulas, when someone is ventilated. Do you have a picture of the ventilator? Right? This is why I keep saying the biggest challenge for families in intensive care is simply that they don't know what they don't know. They don't know what to look for. They don't know what questions to ask. They don't know their rights. And they don't know how to manage doctors and nurses in intensive care. Okay, he's on SIMV. Okay, FiO2 35%. Volume control, yep. Okay, that's good. Has he had a spontaneous breathing trial? Do you know? If he's had a spontaneous breathing trial, and if he had a spontaneous breathing trial, what was the outcome? Okay, what happened with the spontaneous breathing trial? Has he passed the spontaneous breathing trial? Has he passed the spontaneous breathing trial, Ulas? Saying brain signal not coming. Okay, so he hasn't. Okay, that's fine. Is he having IV immunoglobulin therapy? And I'll type that in there so you can actually see it. IV immunoglobulin therapy. Does he have that? Do you know whether he's getting IV immunoglobulin therapy? Also, is he getting mobilized? Is he getting out of bed every day? IVIG given, good. Is he getting mobilized? Is he getting out of bed every day? Yes, okay, good. Okay, so just scrolling back out of 1 month. So he's been in ICU for about 2 months. Is that correct? For about 2 months. 1 month in a coma, 1 month out of a coma. How old is your son? How old is your son? How old is your son, Ulas? You don't want to share. How old is your son? What's his age? What is his age? Okay, so look, my strong recommendation here is he's 16. Oh my goodness, he's a teenager. Okay. Well, the good thing here is that at his age, he should be able to recover. That's the good news. How will he recover? Physical therapy, mobilization. He probably needs the IVIG for some time to come, right? And I do believe you will need to be patient here. Right? And that's easier said than done. But it also sounds to me like he's making some progress. Right? He's making some progress. Get him out of bed, physical therapy, mobilization. You know, hopefully they can wean him gradually off the ventilator. I hope there is no brain damage. Is there? Is there any brain damage as far as you're aware, Ulas? Is there any brain damage as far as you're aware? Okay. All right. While I'm waiting for that, I do want to come back to my other medical report here. Let's assume there's no brain damage, Ulas. You know, he needs to be mobilized. Oh, there is MRI suggestive of diffuse hypoxia brain damage. Okay. Why has there been brain damage? Do you know why? Has there been a cardiac arrest? Has there been a respiratory arrest? Why is there potentially brain damage? Cardiac arrest. That's a bummer. That's a bummer. Oh, yes, you're saying that here, cardiac arrest. Yeah. But he's following command through eyes and slightly through neck. Okay, that's something. Okay. I still go back to that. He needs to be mobilized. He needs to have physical therapy, speech therapy, you know, getting him up every day and hopefully getting him stronger and getting him to wean off the ventilator gradually. I think that would be really important here. Right? Would be really, really important here. Now, let me go back to my clinical report to my doctor's report about this client, about the NDIS client. Like I said, Ulas, mobilization, physiotherapy, speech therapy, wean off the ventilator, step by step. Now, there won't be any quick fix, but I believe this can happen over time. I've seen plenty of Guillain-Barré patients in ICU that do recover over time, but it's often not happening quickly. Now, the complicating factor here might be the cardiac arrest, right? That might be a complicating factor, but you know, you should be positive and optimistic. You should be, because that will help your son. So coming back to our medical report for our ventilated client in the community, so that, you know, this is not a client or someone that can be safely supported by a generic support worker or even a general registered nurse without critical care training. The professor is very clear in his report that a high intensity support worker has no role in managing tracheostomy emergencies. The risk of a preventable death is real and ever present. This level of care is typically beyond what most hospitals provide, let alone support workers at home. According to the report, this NDIS participant requires 24/7 monitoring by critical care registered nurses, CCRNs, skilled ventilator management, including circuit checks, pressure settings, oxygenation monitoring, advanced tracheostomy care, including suctioning and emergency tube changes, as well as non-emergency tube changes, hourly vital sign assessment to detect early deterioration, immediate response capability to seizures or autonomic dysreflexia, 2-to-1 care ratio for all transfers due to risk of decannulation and fractures. Let's be blunt. If this client were left with anyone other than trained ICU nurses, the risk of death is immediate and unacceptable. This is exactly why we at intensivecarehome.com operate under the evidence-based mechanical home ventilation guidelines. And you can find the mechanical home ventilation guidelines that are evidence-based on our website at intensivecarehome.com. NDIS participants like this client deserve the same level of clinical safety at home that they'd get in ICU, but without the hospital walls, the noise, or the institutional mindset. They deserve dignity, autonomy, and to be surrounded by family, not ventilators, beeping in a sterile ICU. At intensivecarehome.com, we provide that very solution by sending the ICU to your home. If you have a loved one on ventilation or with a tracheostomy in or outside of ICU and you're being told, just get a support worker, stop. Stop immediately. Contact us at intensivecarehome.com. We can help you fight for what is medically safe and ethically right and also evidence-based. You can contact us at intensivecarehome.com. So Ulas, just coming back to your messages here, you're saying that the brain stem is normal in the MRI. That's good. That's good. That's why I'm saying to you, you should be optimistic here and fight for your son. Get him out of bed every day. Mobilize him every day. Do the physical therapy. Do all the things that might be hard now, but will pay off in the long run. Okay. So I need to wrap this up in a moment. I usually always go for about an hour here. I do these YouTube live streams every week. Sunday, 10:30 a.m. Sydney, Melbourne time in Australia, which is currently 8:30 p.m. on a Saturday night in the U.S. Eastern Standard Time, which is 5:30 p.m. Pacific time in the U.S. on a Saturday afternoon. And I welcome you to join me live here. That is your opportunity to ask me questions, to ask me anything. And I'll give you the opportunity once a week here. Other than that, keep an eye out on my quick tip videos that are coming during the week, or the intensive care at home videos that are coming during the week. And, you know, if you need one-on-one consulting, reach out at intensivecarehotline.com. Don't leave it too late. Don't come to me when it's too late. Or if you need intensive care at home, just reach out to us at intensivecarehome.com. So, enough for this week. Thank you everyone for watching. If you like my videos, like the videos, subscribe to my YouTube channel for regular updates for families in intensive care. Click the like button, click the notification bell, comment below what you want to see next, what questions and insights you have, and share the video with anyone that will benefit from this video. Thank you so much for watching, and I wish everyone a good week and a good rest of your weekend. Take care for now.